bodies?
They're waiting for the diver's report, said the Coast Guard. I don't know how they get them to go down underwater like that, said the woman. They ought to pay them well. They do that, said the Coast Guard.
I want to be a diver, Mum, said the small boy.
You must ask your daddy, dear, said the woman, laughing at us. It's a lovely spot up here, isn't it, she said to me. We brought a picnic lunch, never thinking it would turn foggy, and we'd have a wreck into the bargain.
We were just thinking of going back to Kerith when the rockets went off under our noses, it seemed. I nearly jumped out of my skin. Why, whatever's that, I said to my husband. That's a distress signal, he said. Let's stop and see the fun. There's no dragging him away. He's as bad as my little boy. I don't see anything in it myself.
No, there's not much to see now, said the Coast Guard.
Those are nice-looking woods over there. I suppose they're private, said the woman.
The Coast Guard coughed awkwardly and glanced at me. I began eating a piece of grass and looked away. Yes, that's all private in there, he said.
My husband says all these big estates will be chopped up in time and bungalows built, said the woman. I wouldn't mind a nice little bungalow up here facing the sea. I don't know that I care for this part of the world in the winter, though.
No, it's very quiet here winter time, said the Coast Guard. I went on chewing my piece of grass. The little boy kept running round in circles. The Coast Guard looked at his watch. Well, I must be getting on, he said. Good afternoon. He saluted me and turned back along the path towards Kerith. Come on, Charlie. Come and find Daddy, said the woman. She nodded to me in friendly fashion and sauntered off to the edge of the cliff, the little boy running at her heels. A thin man in khaki shorts and a striped blazer waved to her. They sat down by a clump of gorse bushes, and the woman began to undo paper packages. I wished I could lose my own identity and join them, eat hard-boiled eggs and potted meat sandwiches, laugh rather loudly, enter their conversation, and then wander back with them during the afternoon to Kerith and paddle on the beach, run races across the stretch of sand, and so to their lodgings, and have shrimps for tea. Instead of which I must go back alone through the woods to Manderley, and wait for Maxim. And I did not know what we should say to one another, how he would look at me, what would be his voice. I went on sitting there on the cliff. I was not hungry. I did not think about lunch. More people came and wandered over the cliffs to look at the ship. It made an excitement for the afternoon. There was nobody I knew. They were all holiday-makers from Kerith. The sea was glassy calm. The gulls no longer wheeled overhead. They had settled on the water a little distance from the ship. More pleasure boats appeared during the afternoon. It must be a field day for Kerith boatmen. The diver came up and then went down again. One of the tugs steamed away while the other still stood by. The harbour-master went back in his grey motorboat, taking some men with him, and the diver, who had come to the surface for the second time. The crew of the ship leant against the side, throwing scraps to the gulls, while visitors in pleasure boats rowed slowly round the ship. Nothing happened at all. It was dead, low water now, and the ship was heeled at an angle, the propeller showing clean. Little ridges of white cloud formed in the western sky, and the sun became pallid. It was still very hot. The woman in the pink-striped frock with the little boy got up and wandered off along the path towards Kerith, the man in the shorts following with the picnic basket. I glanced at my watch. It was after 3 o'clock. I got up and went down the hill to the cove. It was quiet and deserted, as always. The shingle was dark and grey. The water in the little harbour was glassy like a mirror. My feet made a queer crunching noise as I crossed the shingle. The ridges of white cloud now covered all the sky above my head, and the sun was hidden. When I came to the further side of the cove, I saw Ben crouching by a little pool between two rocks, scraping winkles into his hand. My shadow fell upon the water as I passed, and he looked up and saw me. "Good day," he said, his mouth opening in a grin. "Good afternoon," I said. He scrambled to his feet and opened a dirty handkerchief he had filled with winkles. "You eat winkles," he said. I did not want to hurt his feelings. "Thank you," I said. He emptied about a dozen winkles into my hand, and I put them in the two pockets of my skirt. "Them all right with bread and butter," he said. "You must boil 'em first."
"Yes, all right," I said. He stood there, grinning at me.
"Seen the steamer?" he said.
"Yes," I said. "She's gone ashore, hasn't she?"
"Eh?"
he said. "She's run aground," I repeated. "I expect she's got a hole in her bottom."
His face went blank and foolish.
"Aye," he said, "she's down there all right. She'll not come back again."
"Perhaps the tugs will get her off when the tide makes," I said. He did not answer. He was staring out towards the stranded ship. I could see her broadside on from here, the red underwater section showing against the black of the topsides, and the single funnel leaning rakishly towards the cliffs beyond. The crew were still leaning over her side, feeding the gulls and staring into the water. The rowing boats were pulling back to Kerith.
"She's a Dutchman, ain't she?" said Ben.
"I don't know," I said. "German or Dutch."
"She'll break up there where she's to," he said.
"I'm afraid so," I said. He grinned again, and wiped his nose with the back of his hand.
"She'll break up bit by bit," he said. "She'll not sink like a stone like the little un."
He chuckled to himself, picking his nose. I did not say anything.
"The fishes have eaten her up by now, haven't they?" he said.
"Who?" I said. He jerked his thumb towards the sea.
"Her," he said. "The other one."
"Fishes don't eat steamers, Ben," I said.
"Eh?" he said.
He stared at me, foolish and blank once more. "I must go home now," I said. "Good afternoon." I left him and walked towards the path through the woods. I did not look at the cottage. I was aware of it on my right hand, grey and quiet. I went straight to the path and up through the trees. I paused to rest halfway, and looking through the trees I could still see the stranded ship leaning towards the shore. The pleasure boats had all gone. Even the crew had disappeared below. The ridges of cloud covered the whole sky. A little wind sprang from nowhere and blew into my face. A leaf fell onto my hand from the tree above. I shivered for no reason. Then the wind went again. It was hot and sultry as before. The ship looked desolate there upon her side, with no one on her decks, and her thin black funnel pointing to the shore. The sea was so calm that when it broke upon the shingle in the cove, it was like a whisper, hushed and still. I turned once more to the steep path through the woods, my legs reluctant, my head heavy, a strange sense of foreboding in my heart. The house looked very peaceful as I came upon it from the woods and crossed the lawns. It seemed sheltered and protected, more beautiful than I had ever seen it. Standing there, looking down upon it from the banks, I realized, perhaps for the first time, with a funny feeling of bewilderment and pride, that it was my home. I belonged there, and Manderley belonged to me. The trees and the grass and the flower tubs on the terrace were reflected in the mullioned windows. A thin column of smoke rose in the air from one of the chimneys. The new-cut grass on the lawn smelt sweet as hay. A blackbird was singing on the chestnut tree. A yellow butterfly winged his foolish way before me to the terrace. I went into the hall and through to the dining room. My place was still laid, but Maxim's had been cleared away. The cold meat and salad awaited me on the sideboard. I hesitated, and then rang the dining-room bell. Robert came in from behind the screen. "Has Mr. De Winter been in?" I said.
"Yes, madam," said Robert. "He came in just after 2, and had a quick lunch, and then went out again. He asked for you, and Frith said he thought you must have gone down to see the ship."
"Did he say when he would be back again?" I asked.
"No, madam."
"Perhaps he went to the beach another way," I said. "I may have missed him."
"Yes, madam," said Robert.
I looked at the cold meat and the salad. I felt empty, but not hungry. I did not want cold meat now. "Will you be taking lunch?" said Robert. "No," I said. "No, you might bring me some tea, Robert, in the library. Nothing like cakes or scones, just tea and bread and butter."
"Yes, madam."
I went and sat on the window seat in the library. It seemed funny without Jasper. He must have gone with Maxim. The old dog lay asleep in her basket. I picked up the Times and turned the pages without reading it. It was queer, this feeling of marking time, like sitting in a waiting room at a dentist's. I knew I should never settle to my knitting or to a book. I was waiting for something to happen, something unforeseen. The horror of my morning and the stranded ship and not having any lunch had all combined to give birth to a latent sense of excitement at the back of my mind that I did not understand. It was as though I had entered into a new phase of my life, and nothing would be quite the same again. The girl who had dressed for the fancy dress ball the night before had been left behind. It had all happened a very long time ago. This self who sat on the window seat was new, was different. Robert brought in my tea, and I ate my bread and butter hungrily. He had brought scones as well, and some sandwiches, and an angel cake. He must have thought it derogatory to bring bread and butter alone, nor was it Manderley routine. I was glad of the scones and the angel cake. I remembered I had only had cold tea at 11:30 and no breakfast. Just after I had drunk my third cup, Robert came in again. "Mr. De Winter is not back yet, is he, madam?" he said. "No," I said. "Why? Does someone want him?"
"Yes, madam," said Robert. "It's Captain Searle, the harbour-master of Kerith, on the telephone. He wants to know if he can come up and see Mr. De Winter personally."
"I don't know what to say," I said. "He may not be back for ages."
"No, madam."
"You'd better tell him to ring again at 5:00, I said. Robert went out of the room and came back again in a few minutes. "Captain Searle would like to see you if it would be convenient, madam," said Robert. "He says the matter is rather urgent. He tried to get Mr. Crawley, but there was no reply."
"Yes, of course I must see him if it's urgent," I said. "Tell him to come along at once, if he likes. Has he got a car?"
"Yes, I believe so, madam." Robert went out of the room. I wondered what I should say to Captain Searle. His business must be something to do with the stranded ship. I could not understand what concern it was of Maxim's. It would have been different if the ship had gone ashore in the cove. That was Manderley property. They might have to ask Maxim's permission to blast away rocks or whatever it was that was done to move a ship. But the open bay and the ledge of rock under the water did not belong to Maxim. Captain Searle would waste his time talking to me about it all. He must have got into his car right away after talking to Robert, because in less than 1/4 hour he was shown into the room. He was still in his uniform, as I had seen him through the glasses in the early afternoon. I got up from the window seat and shook hands with him. "I'm sorry my husband isn't back yet, Captain Searle," I said. "He must have gone down to the cliffs again, and he went into Kerith before that. I haven't seen him all day."
"Yes, I heard he'd been to Kerith, but I missed him there," said the harbour-master. "He must have walked back across the cliffs when I was in my boat. And I can't get hold of Mr. Crawley, either."
"I'm afraid the ship has disorganized everybody," I said. "I was out on the cliffs and went without my lunch, and I know Mr. Crawley was there earlier on. What will happen to her? Will tugs get her off, do you think?"
Captain Searle made a great circle with his hands. "There's a hole that deep in her bottom," he said. "She'll not see Hamburg again. Never mind the ship. Her owner and Lloyd's agent will settle that between them. No, Mrs. De Winter, it's not the ship that's brought me here. Indirectly, of course, she's the cause of my coming. The fact is, I've got some news for Mr. De Winter, and I hardly know how to break it to him."
He looked at me very straight with his bright blue eyes. "What sort of news, Captain Searle?" He brought a large white handkerchief out of his pocket and blew his nose.
"Well, Mrs. De Winter, it's not very pleasant for me to tell you either. The last thing I want to do is to cause distress or pain to you and your husband. We're all very fond of Mr. De Winter in Kerith, you know, and the family has always done a lot of good. It's hard on him and hard on you that we can't let the past lie quiet. But I don't see how we can under the circumstances."
He paused and put his handkerchief back in his pocket. He lowered his voice, although we were alone in the room. "We sent the diver down to inspect the ship's bottom," he said, "and while he was down there, he made a discovery. It appears he found the hole in the ship's bottom and was working round to the other side to see what further damage there was when he came across the hull of a little sailing boat, lying on her side, quite intact and not broken up at all. He's a local man, of course, and he recognized the boat at once. It was the little boat belonging to the late Mrs. De Winter." My first feeling was one of thankfulness that Maxim was not there to hear. This fresh blow, coming swiftly upon my masquerade of the night before, was ironic and rather horrible. "I'm so sorry," I said slowly. "It's not the sort of thing one expected would happen. Is it necessary to tell Mr. De Winter? Couldn't the boat be left there as it is? It's not doing any harm, is it?"
"It would be left, Mrs. De Winter, in the ordinary way. I'm the last man in the world to want to disturb it, and I'd give anything, as I said before, to spare Mr. De Winter's feelings. But that wasn't all, Mrs. De Winter. My man poked round the little boat, and he made another more important discovery. The cabin door was tightly closed, it was not stove in, and the port lights were closed too. He broke one of the ports with a stone from the seabed and looked into the cabin. It was full of water. The sea must have come through some hole in the bottom. There seemed no damage elsewhere. And then he got the fright of his life, Mrs. De Winter.
Captain Searle paused. He looked over his shoulder as though one of the servants might hear him.
"There was a body in there, lying on the cabin floor," he said quietly. "It was dissolved, of course. There was no flesh on it, but it was a body all right. He saw the head and the limbs. He came up to the surface then and reported it direct to me. And now you understand, Mrs. De Winter, why I've got to see your husband."
I stared at him, bewildered at first, then shocked, then rather sick. "She was supposed to be sailing alone," I whispered. "There must have been someone with her then all the time, and no one ever knew."
"It looks like it," said the harbour master.
"Who could it have been?" I said. "Surely relatives would know if anyone had been missing. There was so much about it at the time, it was all in the papers. Why should one of them be in the cabin, and Mrs. De Winter herself be picked up many miles away months afterwards?"
Captain Searle shook his head. "I can't tell any more than you," he said. "All we know is that the body is there, and it has got to be reported. There'll be publicity, I'm afraid, Mrs. De Winter. I don't know how we're going to avoid it. It's very hard on you and Mr. De Winter. Here you are, settled down quietly, wanting to be happy, and this has to happen."
I knew now the reason for my sense of foreboding. It was not the stranded ship that was sinister, nor the crying gulls, nor the thin black funnel pointing to the shore. It was the stillness of the black water, and the unknown things that lay beneath. It was the diver going down into those cool, quiet depths, and stumbling upon Rebecca's boat, and Rebecca's dead companion. He had touched the boat, had looked into the cabin, and all the while I sat on the cliffs and had not known. "If only we did not have to tell him," I said. "If only we could keep the whole thing from him."
"You know I would if it were possible, Mrs. De Winter," said the harbour master. "But my personal feelings have to go in a matter like this. I've got to do my duty. I've got to report that body."
He broke off short as the door opened, and Maxim came into the room.
"Hello," he said. "What's happening? I didn't know you were here, Captain Searle. Is anything the matter?"
I could not stand it any longer. I went out of the room like the coward I was, and shut the door behind me. I had not even glanced at Maxim's face. I had the vague impression that he looked tired, untidy, hatless. I went and stood in the hall by the front door. Jasper was drinking noisily from his bowl. He wagged his tail when he saw me and went on drinking. Then he loped towards me and stood up, pawing at my dress. I kissed the top of his head and went and sat on the terrace. The moment of crisis had come, and I must face it. My old fears, my diffidence, my shyness, my hopeless sense of inferiority must be conquered now and thrust aside. If I failed now, I should fail forever. There would never be another chance. I prayed for courage in a blind, despairing way, and dug my nails into my hands. I sat there for 5 minutes, staring at the green lawns and the flower tubs on the terrace. I heard the sound of a car starting up in the drive. It must be Captain Searle. He had broken his news to Maxim and had gone. I got up from the terrace and went slowly through the hall to the library. I kept turning over in my pockets the winkles that Ben had given me. I clutched them tight in my hands. Maxim was standing by the window. His back was turned to me. I waited by the door. Still he did not turn round. I took my hands out of my pockets and went and stood beside him. I reached out for his hand and laid it against my cheek. He did not say anything. He went on standing there. "I am so sorry," I whispered. "So terribly, terribly sorry." He did not answer. His hand was icy cold. I kissed the back of it, and then the fingers, one by one. "I don't want you to bear this alone," I said. "I want to share it with you. I've grown up, Maxim, in 24 hours. I'll never be a child again." He put his arm round me and pulled me to him, very close. My reserve was broken, and my shyness too. I stood there with my face against his shoulder. "You've forgiven me, haven't you?" I said.
He spoke to me at last. "Forgiven you?" he said. "What have I got to forgive you for?"
"Last night," I said, "you thought I did it on purpose, "Ah, that," he said. "I'd forgotten. I was angry with you, wasn't I?" "Yes," I said. He did not say any more. He went on holding me close to his shoulder. "Maxim," I said, "can't we start all over again? Can't we begin from today and face things together? I don't want you to love me. I won't ask impossible things. I'll be your friend and your companion, a sort of boy. I don't ever want more than that." He took my face between his hands and looked at me. For the first time I saw how thin his face was, how lined and drawn, and there were great shadows beneath his eyes.
"How much do you love me?" he said.
I could not answer. I could only stare back at him, at his dark, tortured eyes and his pale, drawn face.
"It's too late, my darling, too late," he said. "We've lost our little chance of happiness."
"No, Maxim, no," I said.
"Yes," he said, "it's all over now. The thing has happened."
"What thing?" I said.
"The thing I've always foreseen, the thing I've dreamt about day after day, night after night. We're not meant for happiness, you and I."
He sat down on the window seat, and I knelt in front of him, my hands on his shoulders. "What are you trying to tell me?" I said. He put his hands over mine and looked into my face.
"Rebecca has won," he said.
I stared at him, my heart beating strangely, my hand suddenly cold beneath his hands.
"Her shadow between us all the time," he said. "Her damned shadow keeping us from one another. How could I hold you like this, my darling, my little love, with the fear always in my heart that this would happen?" I remembered her eyes as she looked at me before she died. I remembered that slow, treacherous smile. She knew this would happen even then. She knew she would win in the end.
"Maxim," I whispered, "what are you saying? What are you trying to tell me?"
"Her boat," he said. "They found it. The diver found it this afternoon."
"Yes," I said, "I know. Captain Searle came to tell me. You are thinking about the body, aren't you? The body the diver found in the cabin."
"Yes," he said.
"It means she was not alone," I said. "It means there was somebody sailing with Rebecca at the time. And you have to find out who it was. That's it, isn't it, Maxim?"
"No," he said. "No, you don't understand."
"I want to share this with you, darling," I said. "I want to help you."
"There was no one with Rebecca. She was alone," he said.
I knelt there watching his face, watching his eyes.
"It's Rebecca's body lying there on the cabin floor," he said.
"No," I said. "No."
"The woman buried in the crypt is not Rebecca," he said. "It's the body of some unknown woman, unclaimed, belonging nowhere. There never was an accident. Rebecca was not drowned at all. I killed her. I shot Rebecca in the cottage in the cove. I carried her body to the cabin and took the boat out that night and sunk it there, where they found it today. It's Rebecca who's lying dead there on the cabin floor. Will you look into my eyes and tell me that you love me now?"
Chapter 20. It was very quiet in the library. The only sound was that of Jasper licking his foot. He must have caught a thorn in his pads, for he kept biting and sucking at the skin. Then I heard the watch on Maxim's wrist ticking close to my ear. The little normal sounds of every day. And for no reason, the stupid proverb of my schooldays ran through my mind. "Time and tide wait for no man." The words repeated themselves over and over again. "Time and tide wait for no man." These were the only sounds then. The ticking of Maxim's watch, and Jasper licking his foot on the floor beside me. When people suffer a great shock, like death or the loss of a limb, I believe they don't feel it just at first. If your hand is taken from you, you don't know for a few minutes that your hand is gone. You go on feeling the fingers.
You stretch and beat them on the air one by one, and all the time there is nothing there, no hand, no fingers. I knelt there by Maxim's side, my body against his body, my hands upon his shoulders, and I was aware of no feeling at all, no pain and no fear. There was no horror in my heart. I thought how I must take the thorn out of Jasper's foot, and I wondered if Robert would come in and clear the tea things. It seemed strange to me that I should think of these things. Jasper's foot, Maxim's watch, Robert and the tea things. I was shocked at my lack of emotion and this queer cold absence of distress. Little by little the feeling will come back to me, I said to myself. Little by little I shall understand. What he has told me and all that has happened will tumble into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. They will fit themselves into a pattern. At the moment I am nothing. I have no heart and no mind and no senses. I am just a wooden thing in Maxim's arms. Then he began to kiss me. He had not kissed me like this before. I put my hands behind his head and shut my eyes. "I love you so much," he whispered. "So much." This is what I have wanted him to say every day and every night, I thought, and now he is saying it at last. This is what I imagined in Monte Carlo, in Italy, here in Mandalay. He is saying it now. I opened my eyes and looked at a little patch of curtain above his head. He went on kissing me, hungry, desperate, murmuring my name. I kept on looking at the patch of curtain and saw where the sun had faded it, making it lighter than the piece above. How calm I am, I thought. How cool. Here I am looking at the piece of curtain, and Maxim is kissing me. For the first time, he is telling me he loves me. Then he stopped, suddenly. He pushed me away from him and got up from the window seat. "You see, I was right," he said. "It's too late. You don't love me now. Why should you?" He went and stood over by the mantelpiece. "We'll forget that," he said. "It won't happen again." Realization flooded me at once, and my heart jumped in quick and sudden panic. "It's not too late," I said swiftly, getting up from the floor and going to him, putting my arms about him. "You're not to say that. You don't understand. I love you more than anything in the world. But when you kissed me just now, I felt stunned and shaken. I could not feel anything. I could not grasp anything. It was just as though I had no more feeling left in me at all."
"You don't love me," he said. "That's why you did not feel anything. I know. I understand. It's come too late for you, hasn't it?"
"No," I said.
"This ought to have happened 4 months ago," he said. "I should have known. Women are not like men."
"I want you to kiss me again," I said. "Please, Maxim."
"No," he said. "It's no use now."
"We can't lose each other now," I said. "We've got to be together always, with no secrets, no shadows. Please, darling, please."
"There's no time," he said. "We may only have a few hours, a few days. How can we be together now that this has happened? I've told you they've found the boat. They've found Rebecca."
I stared at him stupidly, not understanding. "What will they do?" I said.
"They'll identify her body," he said. "There's everything to tell them there in the cabin, the clothes she had, the shoes, the rings on her fingers. They'll identify her body, and then they will remember the other one, the woman buried up there in the crypt."
"What are you going to do?" I whispered.
"I don't know," he said. "I don't know."
The feeling was coming back to me, little by little, as I knew it would. My hands were cold no longer. They were clammy, warm. I felt a wave of colour come into my face, my throat. My cheeks were burning hot. I thought of Captain Searle, the diver, the Lloyd's agent. All those men on the stranded ship leaning against the side, staring down into the water. I thought of the shopkeepers in Kerith, of errand boys whistling in the street, of the vicar walking out of church, of Lady Crowan cutting roses in her garden, of the woman in the pink dress and her little boy on the cliffs. Soon they would know, in a few hours, by breakfast time tomorrow. They found Mrs. De Winter's boat, and they say there is a body in the cabin. A body in the cabin. Rebecca was lying there on the cabin floor. She was not in the crypt at all. Some other woman was lying in the crypt. Maxim had killed Rebecca. Rebecca had not been drowned at all. Maxim had killed her.
He had shot her in the cottage in the woods. He had carried her body to the boat and sunk the boat there in the bay. That grey, silent cottage with the rain pattering on the roof. The jigsaw pieces came tumbling thick and fast upon me. Disjointed pictures flashed one by one through my bewildered mind. Maxim sitting in the car beside me in the south of France. Something happened nearly a year ago that altered my whole life. I had to begin living all over again. Maxim's silence, Maxim's moods, the way he never talked about Rebecca, the way he never mentioned her name, Maxim's dislike of the cove, the stone cottage. If you had my memories, you would not go there either. The way he climbed the path through the woods, not looking behind him, Maxim pacing up and down the library after Rebecca died, up and down, up and down. I came away in rather a hurry, he said to Mrs. Van Hopper. A line, thin as gossamer between his brows. They say he can't get over his wife's death. The fancy dress dance last night. And I coming down to the head of the stairs in Rebecca's dress. I killed Rebecca, Maxim had said. I shot Rebecca in the cottage in the woods. And the diver had found her lying there on the cabin floor. What are we going to do, I said. What are we going to say? Maxim did not answer. He stood there by the mantelpiece, his eyes wide and staring, looking in front of him, not seeing anything. Does anyone know, I said. Anyone at all? He shook his head. No, he said. No one but you and me, I asked. No one but you and me, he said. Frank, I said suddenly. Are you sure Frank does not know? How could he, said Maxim. There was nobody there but myself. It was dark. He stopped. He sat down on a chair. He put his hand up to his forehead. I went and knelt beside him. He sat very still a moment. I took his hands away from his face and looked into his eyes. I love you, I whispered. I love you. Will you believe me now? He kissed my face and my hands. He held my hands very tightly, like a child who would gain confidence. I thought I should go mad, he said. Sitting here day after day, waiting for something to happen. Sitting down at the desk there, answering those terrible letters of sympathy. The notices in the papers, the interviews, all the little aftermath of death. Eating and drinking, trying to be normal, trying to be sane. Frith, the servants, Mrs. Danvers. Mrs. Danvers, who I had not the courage to turn away, because with her knowledge of Rebecca she might have suspected. She might have guessed. Frank always by my side, discreet, sympathetic. "Why don't you get away?" he used to say. "I can manage here. You ought to get away." And Giles, and B, poor dear tactless B, "you're looking frightfully ill. Can't you go and see a doctor?" I had to face them all, these people, knowing every word I uttered was a lie. I went on holding his hands very tight. I leant close to him, quite close. "I nearly told you once," he said. "That day Jasper ran to the cove and you went to the cottage for some string. We were sitting here like this and then Frith and Robert came in with the tea."
"Yes," I said. "I remember. Why didn't you tell me? The time we've wasted when we might have been together. All these weeks and days."
"You were so aloof," he said. "Always wandering into the garden with Jasper, going off on your own. You never came to me like this."
"Why didn't you tell me?" I whispered. "Why didn't you tell me?"
"I thought you were unhappy. Bored," he said. "I'm so much older than you. You seemed to have more to say to Frank than you ever had to me. You were funny with me. Awkward. Shy."
"How could I come to you when I knew you were thinking about Rebecca?" I said. "How could I ask you to love me when I knew you loved Rebecca still?" He pulled me close to him and searched my eyes.
"What are you talking about? What do you mean?" he said.
I knelt up straight beside him. "Whenever you touched me, I thought you were comparing me to Rebecca," I said. "Whenever you spoke to me or looked at me, walked with me in the garden, sat down to dinner, I felt you were saying to yourself, 'This I did with Rebecca, and this, and this.'" He stared at me, bewildered, as though he did not understand. "It was true, wasn't it?" I said.
"Oh, my God," he said.
He pushed me away. He got up and began walking up and down the room, clasping his hands. "What is it? What's the matter?" I said. He whipped round and looked at me as I sat there huddled on the floor.
"You thought I loved Rebecca," he said. "You thought I killed her, loving her. I hated her, I tell you. Our marriage was a farce from the very first. She was vicious, damnable, rotten, through and through. We never loved each other, never had one moment of happiness together. Rebecca was incapable of love, of tenderness, of decency. She was not even normal."
I sat on the floor, clasping my knees, staring at him.
"She was clever, of course," he said. "Damnably clever. No one would guess, meeting her, that she was not the kindest, most generous, most gifted person in the world. She knew exactly what to say to different people, how to match her mood to theirs. Had she met you, she would have walked off into the garden with you arm in arm, calling to Jasper, chatting about flowers, music, painting, whatever she knew to be your particular hobby, and you would have been taken in like the rest. You would have sat at her feet and worshipped her."
Up and down he walked, up and down across the library floor.
"When I married her, I was told I was the luckiest man in the world," he said. "She was so lovely, so accomplished, so amusing. Even Gran, the most difficult person to please in those days, adored her from the first. She's got the three things that matter in a wife," she told me, "breeding, brains, and beauty." And I believed her, or forced myself to believe her. But all the time I had a seed of doubt at the back of my mind. There was something about her eyes.
The jigsaw pieces came together piece by piece. The real Rebecca took shape and form before me, stepping from her shadow world like a living figure from a picture frame. Rebecca slashing at her horse, Rebecca seizing life with her two hands, Rebecca triumphant, leaning down from the minstrel's gallery with a smile on her lips. Once more I saw myself standing on the beach beside poor startled Ben.
"You're kind," he said, "not like the other one. You won't put me to the asylum, will you?"
There was someone who walked through the woods by night, someone tall and slim. She gave you the feeling of a snake. Maxim was talking, though. Maxim was walking up and down the library floor.
"I found her out at once," he was saying, "5 days after we were married. You remember that time I drove you in the car to the hills above Monte Carlo? I wanted to stand there again, to remember." She sat there laughing, her black hair blowing in the wind. She told me about herself. Told me things I shall never repeat to a living soul. I knew then what I had done, what I had married. Beauty, brains, and breeding. Oh, my God!
He broke off abruptly. He went and stood by the window, looking out upon the lawns. He began to laugh. He stood there, laughing. I could not bear it. It made me frightened, ill. I could not stand it. "Maxim," I cried, "Maxim!" He lit a cigarette and stood there smoking, not saying anything. Then he turned away again and paced up and down the room once more.
"I nearly killed her then," he said. "It would have been so easy. One false step, one slip. You remember the precipice? I frightened you, didn't I? You thought I was mad. Perhaps I was. Perhaps I am. It doesn't make for sanity, does it? Living with the devil."
I sat there watching him, up and down, up and down.
"She made a bargain with me up there on the side of the precipice," he said. "I'll run your house for you," she told me. "I'll look after your precious Manderley for you. Make it the most famous show place in all the country, if you like. And people will visit us, and envy us, and talk about us. They'll say we're the luckiest, happiest, handsomest couple in all England. What a leg pull, Max," she said. "What a goddamn triumph." She sat there on the hillside laughing, tearing a flower to bits in her hands.
Maxim threw his cigarette away, a quarter smoked, into the empty grate.
"I did not kill her," he said. "I watched her. I said nothing. I let her laugh. We got into the car together and drove away. And she knew I would do as she suggested. Come here to Manderley, throw the place open, entertain, have our marriage spoken of as the success of the century. She knew I would sacrifice pride, honour, personal feelings, every damned quality on earth, rather than stand before our little world after a week of marriage and have them know the things about her that she had told me then. She knew I would never stand in a divorce court and give her away, have fingers pointing at us, mud flung at us in the newspapers, all the people who belong down here whispering when my name was mentioned, all the trippers from Kerith trooping to the lodge gates, peering into the grounds and saying, "That's where he lives, in there, that's Manderley. That's the place that belongs to the chap who had that divorce case we read about. Do you remember what the judge said about his wife?"
He came and stood before me. He held out his hands.
"You despise me, don't you?" he said. "You can't understand my shame and loathing and disgust."
I did not say anything. I held his hands against my heart. I did not care about his shame. None of the things that he had told me mattered to me at all. I clung to one thing only, and repeated it to myself over and over again. Maxim did not love Rebecca. He had never loved her. Never. Never. They had never known one moment's happiness together. Maxim was talking, and I listened to him, but his words meant nothing to me. I did not really care.
"I thought about Manderley too much," he said. "I put Manderley first before anything else, and it does not prosper, that sort of love. They don't preach about it in the churches. Christ said nothing about stones and bricks and walls, the love that a man can bear for his plot of earth, his soil, his little kingdom. It does not come into the Christian creed."
"My darling," I said, "my Maxim, my love." I laid his hands against my face. I put my lips against them.
"Do you understand?" he said. "Do you? Do you?"
"Yes," I said, "my sweet, my love." But I looked away from him so he should not see my face. What did it matter whether I understood him or not? My heart was light like a feather floating in the air. He had never loved Rebecca.
"I don't want to look back on those years," he said slowly. "I don't want even to tell you about them. The shame and the degradation. The lie we lived, she and I. The shabby, sordid farce we played together. Before friends, before relations, even before the servants, before faithful, trusting preachers like old Frith. They all believed in her down here. They all admired her. They never knew how she laughed at them behind their backs, jeered at them, mimicked them. I can remember days when the place was full for some show or other, a garden party, a pageant, and she walked about with a smile like an angel on her face, her arm through mine, giving prizes afterwards to a little troop of children, and then the day afterwards she would be up at dawn driving to London, streaking to that flat of hers by the river like an animal to its hole in the ditch, coming back here at the end of the week, after 5 unspeakable days. Oh, I kept to my side of the bargain, all right. I never gave her away. Her blasted taste made Manderley the thing it is today. The gardens, the shrubs, even the azaleas in the Happy Valley. Do you think they existed when my father was alive? God, the place was a wilderness. Lovely, yes, wild and lonely, with a beauty of its own, yes, but crying out for skill and care and the money that he would never give to it, that I would not have thought of giving to it, but for Rebecca. Half the stuff you see here in the rooms was never here originally. The drawing room as it is today, the morning room, that's all Rebecca. Those chairs that Frith points out so proudly to the visitors on the public day, and that panel of tapestry, Rebecca again. Oh, some of the things were here, admittedly stored away in back rooms. My father knew nothing about furniture or pictures, but the majority was bought by Rebecca. The beauty of Manderley that you see today, the Manderley that people talk about and photograph and paint, it's all due to her, to Rebecca. I did not say anything. I held him close. I wanted him to go on talking like this, that his bitterness might loosen and come away, carrying with it all the pent-up hatred and disgust and muck of the lost years. "And so we lived," he said, "month after month, year after year. I accepted everything because of Manderley. What she did in London did not touch me, because it did not hurt Manderley. And she was careful those first years. There was never a murmur about her, never a whisper. Then, little by little, she began to grow careless. You know how a man starts drinking. He goes easy at first, just a little at a time, a bad bout perhaps every 5 months or so. And then the period between grows less and less. Soon it's every month, every fortnight, every few days. There's no margin of safety left, and all his secret cunning goes. It was like that with Rebecca. She began to ask her friends down here. She would have one or two of them, and mix them up at a weekend party, so that at first I was not quite sure, not quite certain. She would have picnics down at her cottage in the cove. I came back once, having been away shooting in Scotland, and found her there, with half a dozen of them, people I'd never seen before. I warned her, and she shrugged her shoulders. "What the hell's it got to do with you?" she said. I told her she could see her friends in London, but Manderley was mine. She must stick to that part of the bargain. She smiled. She did not say anything. Then she started on Frank, poor, shy, faithful Frank. He came to me one day and said he wanted to leave Manderley and take another job. We argued for 2 hours here in the library. And then I understood. He broke down and told me. She never left him alone, he said. She was always going down to his house trying to get him to the cottage. Dear, wretched Frank, who had not understood, who had always thought we were the normal, happy, married couple we pretended to be. I accused Rebecca of this, and she flared up at once, cursing me, using every filthy word in her particular vocabulary. We had a sickening, loathsome scene. She went up to London after that and stayed there for a month. When she came back again, she was quiet at first. I thought she had learnt her lesson. B and Giles came for a weekend, and I realized then, what I had sometimes suspected before, that B did not like Rebecca. I believe in her funny, abrupt, downright way she saw through her, guessed something was wrong. It was a tricky, nervy sort of weekend. Giles went out sailing with Rebecca. B and I lazed on the lawn. And when they came back, I could tell by Giles's rather hearty, jovial manner and by a look in Rebecca's eye that she had started on him, as she had done on Frank. I saw B watching Giles at dinner, who laughed louder than usual, talked a little too much. And all the while Rebecca, sitting there at the head of the table, looking like an angel. They were all fitting into place, the jigsaw pieces. The odd, strange shapes that I had tried to piece together with my fumbling fingers, and they had never fitted. Frank's odd manner when I spoke about Rebecca, Beatrice and her rather diffident, negative attitude. The silence that I had always taken for sympathy and regret was a silence born of shame and embarrassment. It seemed incredible to me now that I had never understood. I wondered how many people there were in the world who suffered and continued to suffer because they could not break out from their own web of shyness and reserve, and in their blindness and folly built up a great distorted wall in front of them that hid the truth. This was what I had done. I had built up false pictures in my mind and sat before them. I had never had the courage to demand the truth. Had I made one step forward out of my own shyness, Maxim would have told me these things 4 months, 5 months ago. That was the last weekend B and Giles ever spent at Manderley, said Maxim. I never asked them alone again. They came officially to garden parties and dances. B never said a word to me or I to her, but I think she guessed my life. I think she knew, even as Frank did. Rebecca grew cunning again. Her behaviour was faultless, outwardly. But if I happened to be away, when she was here at Manderley, I could never be certain what might happen. There had been Frank and Giles. She might get hold of one of the workmen on the estate, someone from Kerith, anyone, and then the bomb would have to fall, the gossip, the publicity I dreaded. It seemed to me I stood again by the cottage in the woods, and I heard the drip-drip of the rain upon the roof. I saw the dust on the model ships, the rat-holes on the divan. I saw Ben with his poor, staring idiot's eyes. "You'll not put me to the asylum, will you?" And I thought of the dark, steep path through the woods. And how, if a woman stood there behind the trees, her evening dress would rustle in the thin night breeze. "She had a cousin," said Maxim slowly, "a fellow who had been abroad and was living in England again. He took to coming here if ever I was away. Frank used to see him. A fellow called Jack Favell."
"I know him," I said. "He came here the day you went to London."
"You saw him too," said Maxim. "Why didn't you tell me?" "I heard it from Frank, who saw his car turn in at the lodge gates."
"I did not like to," I said. "I thought it would remind you of Rebecca."
"Remind me," whispered Maxim. "Oh, God, as if I needed reminding."
He stared in front of him, breaking off from his story. And I wondered if he was thinking, as I was, of that flooded cabin beneath the waters in the bay.
"She used to have this fellow Favell down to the cottage," said Maxim. "She would tell the servant she was going to sail, and would not be back before the morning. Then she would spend the night down there with him. Once again I warned her. I said if I found him here, anywhere on the estate, I'd shoot him. He had a black, filthy record. The very thought of him walking about the woods in Manderley in places like the Happy Valley made me mad. I told her I would not stand for it. She shrugged her shoulders. She forgot to blaspheme. And I noticed she was looking paler than usual, nervy, rather haggard. I wondered then what the hell would happen to her when she began to look old, feel old. Things drifted on. Nothing very much happened. Then one day she went up to London and came back again the same day, which she did not do as a rule. I did not expect her. I dined that night with Frank at his house. We had a lot of work on at the time. He was speaking now in short, jerky sentences. I had his hands very tightly between my two hands. I came back after dinner, about 10:30, and I saw her scarf and gloves lying on a chair in the hall. I wondered what the devil she had come back for. I went into the morning room, but she was not there. I guess she had gone off there then, down to the cove. And I knew then. I could not stand this life of lies and filth and deceit any longer. The thing had got to be settled one way or the other. I thought I'd take a gun and frighten the fellow, frighten them both. I went down right away to the cottage. The servants never knew I had come back to the house at all. I slipped out into the garden and through the woods. I saw the light in the cottage window, and I went straight in. To my surprise, Rebecca was alone. She was lying on the divan, with an ashtray full of cigarette stubs beside her. She looked ill, queer. I began at once about Favelle, and she listened to me without a word. "We've lived this life of degradation long enough, you and I said. This is the end, do you understand? What you do in London does not concern me. You can live with Favelle there, or with anyone you like, but not here, not at Manderley." She said nothing for a moment. She stared at me, and then she smiled. "Suppose it suits me better to live here. What then?" she said. "You know the conditions," I said. "I've kept my part of our dirty, damnable bargain, haven't I? But you've cheated. You think you can treat my house and my home like your own sink in London. I've stood enough, but my God, Rebecca, this is your last chance." I remember she squashed out her cigarette in the tub by the divan, and then she got up and stretched herself, her arms above her head. "You're right, Max," she said. "It's time I turned over a new leaf." She looked very pale, very thin. She began walking up and down the room, her hands in the pockets of her trousers. She looked like a boy in her sailing kit, a boy with a face like a Botticelli angel. "Have you ever thought," she said, "how damned hard it would be for you to make a case against me? In a court of law, I mean. If you wanted to divorce me, do you realize that you've never had one shred of proof against me from the very first? All your friends, even the servants, believe our marriage to be a success. What about Frank?" I said. "What about Beatrice?" She threw back her head and laughed. "What sort of a story could Frank tell against mine?" she said. "Don't you know me well enough for that? As for Beatrice, wouldn't it be the easiest thing in the world for her to stand in a witness box as the ordinary jealous woman whose husband once lost his head and made a fool of himself? Oh, no, Max, you'd have a hell of a time trying to prove anything against me." She stood watching me, rocking on her heels, her hands in her pockets and a smile on her face. "Do you realize that I could get Danny, as my personal maid, to swear anything I asked her to swear in a court of law, and that the rest of the servants in blind ignorance would follow her example and swear too? They think we live together at Manderley as husband and wife, don't they? And so does everyone, your friends, all our little world. Well, how are you going to prove that we don't?" She sat down on the edge of the table, swinging her legs, watching me. "Haven't we acted the parts of a loving husband and wife rather too well?" she said. I remember watching that foot of hers in its striped sandal swinging backwards and forwards, and my eyes and brain began to burn in a strange, quick way. "We could make you look very foolish, Danny and I," she said softly. "We could make you look so foolish that no one would believe you, Max, nobody at all." Still that foot of hers, swinging to and fro, that damned foot in its blue and white striped sandal. Suddenly she slipped off the table and stood in front of me, smiling still, her hands in her pockets. "If I had a child, Max," she said, "neither you nor anyone in the world would ever prove that it was not yours. It would grow up here in Manderley, bearing your name. There would be nothing you could do, and when you died, Manderley would be his. You could not prevent it. The property's entailed. You would like an heir, wouldn't you, for your beloved Manderley? You would enjoy it, wouldn't you, seeing my son lying in his pram under the chestnut tree, playing leapfrog on the lawn, catching butterflies in the Happy Valley? It would give you the biggest thrill of your life, wouldn't it, Max, to watch my son grow bigger day by day, and to know that when you died, all this would be his. She waited a minute, rocking on her heels, and then she lit a cigarette and went down and stood by the window. She began to laugh. She went on laughing. I thought she would never stop. "God, how funny," she said. "How supremely, wonderfully funny. Well, you heard me say I was going to turn over a new leaf, didn't you? Now you know the reason. They'll be happy, won't they? All these smug locals, all your blasted tenants. 'It's what we've always hoped for, Mrs. de Winter,' they will say. 'I'll be the perfect mother, Max, like I've been the perfect wife. And none of them will ever guess. None of them will ever know.'" She turned round and faced me, smiling, one hand in her pocket, the other holding her cigarette. When I killed her, she was smiling still. I fired at her heart. The bullet passed right through. She did not fall at once. She stood there, looking at me, that slow smile on her face, her eyes wide open. Maxim's voice had sunk low, so low that it was like a whisper. The hand that I held between my own was cold. I did not look at him. I watched Jasper's sleeping body on the carpet beside me, the little thump of his tail now and then upon the floor. "I'd forgotten," said Maxim, and his voice was slow now, tired, without expression, "that when you shot a person, there was so much blood." There was a hole there on the carpet beneath Jasper's tail, the burnt hole from a cigarette. I wondered how long it had been there. Some people said ash was good for the carpets. "I had to get water from the cove," said Maxim. "I had to keep going backwards and forwards to the cove for water. Even by the fireplace, where she had not been, there was a stain. It was all round where she lay on the floor. It began to blow, too. There was no catch on the window. The window kept banging backwards and forwards while I knelt there on the floor with that dishcloth and the bucket beside me. And the rain on the roof, I thought. He does not remember. The rain on the roof. It pattered thin and light and very fast. "I carried her out to the boat," he said. "It must have been 11:30 by then, nearly 12. It was quite dark. There was no moon. The wind was squally from the west. I carried her down to the cabin and left her there. Then I had to get under way with the dinghy astern and beat out of the little harbour against the tide. The wind was with me, but it came in puffs, and I was in the lee there, under cover of the headland. I remember I got the mainsail jammed halfway up the mast. I had not done it, you see, for a long time. I never went out with Rebecca. And I thought of the tide, how swift it ran and strong into the little cove. The wind blew down from the headland like a funnel. I got the boat out into the bay. I got her out there, beyond the beacon, and I tried to go about to clear the ridge of rocks. The little jib fluttered. I could not sheet it in. A puff of wind came, and the sheet tore out of my hands, went twisting round the mast. The sail thundered and shook. It cracked like a whip above my head. I could not remember what one had to do. I could not remember. I tried to reach that sheet, and it blew above me in the air. Another blast of wind came straight ahead. We began to drift sideways, closer to the ridge. It was dark, so damned dark I couldn't see anything on the black, slippery deck. Somehow I blundered down into the cabin. I had a spike with me. If I didn't do it now, it would be too late. We were getting so near to the ridge. And in 6 or 7 minutes, drifting like this, we should be out of deep water. I opened the seacocks. The water began to come in. I drove the spike into the bottom boards. One of the planks split right across. I took the spike out and began to drive in another plank. The water came up over my feet. I left Rebecca lying on the floor. I fastened both the scuttles. I bolted the door. When I came up on deck, I saw we were within 20 yards of the ridge. I threw some of the loose stuff on the deck into the water.
There was a life buoy, a pair of sweeps, a coil of rope. I climbed into the dinghy. I pulled away and lay back on the paddles and watched. The boat was drifting still. She was sinking, too, sinking by the head. The jib was still shaking and cracking like a whip. I thought someone must hear it, someone walking the cliffs late at night, some fisherman.